Thank you. And thank you all for inviting me. Some of you may know that I was among the first people to propose the multiverse as an explanation for the small value of the cosmological constant. Some of you may also know that I've been one of the biggest critics of the string landscape proposal. And I've spent enough of my life criticizing and giving talks about that. I think you should be aware, if you're not a string theorist, that this is not as solidly based as many string theorists would have you believe. And if you peruse the last two papers that I wrote the names of down on the board, you can see my arguments for that. I'll only recall one of these arguments, which was given in the paper with Dine and Gorbatov, namely that there is, with the string landscape specifically, a phenomenological issue, namely what these kinds of multiverse theories tend to predict is that many of the parameters in the low energy effect of Lagrangian describing our world are statistical and are subject to anthropic selection effects because they're statistical, because there are a lot of possibilities for what they could be, and we will only exist in some of them. In the string theory landscape, at least at the level at which it's understood today, it seems like many, if not all, of the parameters of the low energy effect of Lagrangian have the same statistical character. And there are many of them that are extremely finely tuned in the real world, that is to say, have values which we find confusing in the language that David and I were talking about in the previous talk. And those values can't be explained by anthropic selection. So the theta parameter of QCD is one example. There are many others. That's a reason to be skeptical, a actual experimental phenomenological reason to be skeptical of the string landscape. Today I'm going to talk about something quite different. And although I've given the talk the title of multiverse, and as you'll see, there is a multiverse here in principle, and that multiverse can be used to select out anthropically a small value of the cosmological constant, it probably doesn't do very much more than that. And there are some arguments that suggest that the other parameters of low energy physics are not affected by it. As a consequence of that, it probably doesn't have very many experimental consequences. And therefore, as you'll see, you might as well think of the cosmological constant as a cosmological initial condition. And as far as I'm concerned, you can take your pick between those two ways of thinking about what I'm going to tell you about. But since this is a conference on the multiverse, I put the multiverse word in the title. So I first have to introduce to you very quickly, and I have to apologize. Like many people here, I'm going to be telling you about previous technical work in a really rather cursory manner. Some of you will have heard of this. Some of you will have read about it. But many of you will not, and I apologize for that. But there just isn't time to do everything. It would take several talks of this length to actually completely outline this formalism. The basic idea is that the holographic principle, which is, as formulated by Fischler and Susskind and Busso, a bound on the total entropy that can be associated with a given space-time region. Now, as Busso formulated it, there are many different space-time regions one can choose, but a very particular set of space-time regions which are of interest, for which there are always holographic bounds, are causal diamonds. That is to say, the intersection of the interior of the past light cone of some point with the future light cone of some point in its causal past. And causal diamonds, if you look on their null boundary, you will always find a maximal area d minus 2 surface, where d is the dimension of space-time when you try to foliate the boundary. And the area divided by 4 in Planck units of that surface, where area means d minus 2 area in a d-dimensional context, is supposed to bound the entropy associated with that region of spacetime. Now, Fischler and I suggested entropy in quantum mechanics is the entropy of some density matrix. I should emphasize to you, I will be dealing with the vanilla formulation of quantum mechanics throughout. No generalizations, no nothing. Everything is just ordinary Copenhagen quantum mechanics. General quantum mechanics, the entropy is the entropy of some density matrix. In a theory that's supposed to be a theory of general spacetimes, there aren't special operators like Hamiltonians. Hamiltonians have to do with global time like Killing vectors. We don't have that. They have to do with infinite asymptotic boundaries. We don't necessarily have that. We certainly don't have that in a small finite causal diamond. And so we suggested that the only natural general density matrix that one could be talking about in the covariant entropy bound was the completely uncertain one. Namely, the entropy is the logarithm of the dimension of the Hilbert space associated with that spacetime region. And this allows one to make a mapping between a geometrical concept, a causal diamond with a certain area, and a quantum mechanical concept, namely a Hilbert space. Yeah.
Space-time here to define these quantities,
so
therefore ruling out
one of the things that this formalism will a priori do is deny the notion that quantum gravity is a theory of fluctuating space-time geometries. We will see here that the quantum concepts that we put together, out of which we are supposed to get a classical space-time geometry at the end, are completely fixed. And the things that you would associate with the causal structure and conformal factor of a metric, and which we claim you can so associate in the limit of very large causal diamonds, those things will not be fluctuating quantum variables. We believe that the right way to think about the metric in spacetime is not like a semi-classical variable which is to be quantized, but rather like the kind of classical variable that one gets in a large N matrix theory. In large N matrix theories, in the large N limit, and in all orders in perturbation theory around it, there are certain quantum variables that you can write down that appear to be ordinary canonical quantum variables. But when you actually go to finite N, you find that those variables don't actually exist. They don't satisfy quantum canonical commutation relations. There are all kinds of constraints on them coming from the fact that they're built out of matrices of finite dimension. So we think of the space-time metric more in that fashion. And indeed, there's no fluctuating background space-time.
Even in the linear level, right? So no gravitational space.
No. Perturbations around a given space-time background are things that you would think of as the 1 over n expansion around a given classical solution for these collective variables of the 1 over n formalism.
Thank you.
And so those are quantized in the usual way. OK, so here's a setup, a bunch of causal diamonds. And if I have a pair of causal diamonds, say this one and this one, there's some intersection region between them. That intersection in higher dimensions than 1 plus 1 is not itself a causal diamond, but it has inside it a maximal area causal diamond, which we call the intersection. And then we make an ansatz that says, how do we relate the causal properties of space-time to Hilbert space concepts? Well, you want, if there's a causal diamond and there are degrees of freedom that are related just to that causal diamond, they should commute with everything outside of that. And so the algebra of operators associated with that maximal diamond in the intersection should be a tensor factor in the algebra of all operators, both in the Hilbert space of the first diamond and in the Hilbert space of the second. So in general, I'll show you pictures of this in a minute. We think about a fixed time. This label n is both going to label time, and as we'll see, will also label the size of a causal diamond. And then it sits at a bunch of points, x and y, that sit on a spatial lattice. That spatial lattice will represent the topology of the non-compact dimensions of space-time, okay, which are assumed in this formalism to be unchanging. We're building a formalism with that property. There is no geometry on that lattice, only its topology. So these are just labels for the points, and we know which points are neighbors of which, and so on and so forth. At each point, x and y, at each time, we have a Hilbert space that represents a causal diamond that's somehow associated with that point. And what the association is will depend on what kind of space-time we're talking about. The dimension of this Hilbert space, n, which, as I told you, is going to be related in the limit of large diamonds or large dimension to areas of the so-called holographic screen, is given for the nth Hilbert space by a fixed dimension to the nth power. We'll call a single one of these Hilbert spaces that it gets raised to the nth power, the Hilbert space of a single pixel on the holographic screen. And the picture you should have in mind is something like the following. The holographic entropy bound tells you that the area, the entropy of a causal diamond is extensive in the area of its holographic screen. And so imagine breaking up the holographic screen into pixels. And just for the moment, think of a pixel like a little square area or something like that. And for each of those, we'll have some finite independent set of quantum degrees of freedom, finite in the sense of finite dimensional Hilbert space. The Hilbert space is a representation of a certain algebra. This is a finite dimensional superalgebra. This should have been anti-commutators rather than commutators. These objects S are spinners. And the way that they're related to the space-time concept of a holographic screen is the following. If I think about a pixel on a holographic screen, it's a little transverse piece of a null surface. So if I think about the null ray that's going out through that holographic screen and the transverse null surface that it's going through, that is the orientation of that little bit of the holographic screen in space-time. Now, it's an old story, first demonstrated by Cartan and Penrose, that that information up to a multiplicative factor is contained in the solution of this equation. I take a Dirac spinner and take chi bar, really, but my computer doesn't allow me to make bars very easily, gamma mu chi, dotted into the matrix gamma mu, acting on chi, set it equal to 0. That says that the bilinear chi bar gamma mu chi is a null vector. And then this further constraint on chi itself, this trilinear relation, says that chi is a light cone spinner for that null vector. It has half the components of the full Dirac spinner. And what I've done here is taken those half of the components, and I've broken up the spinner indices, as usual, into indices, a tensor product of indices associated with the non-compact space, in which I have transverse rotational invariance, and indices associated with the compact space, in which I don't. These MIJs are in the bi-spinner representation in the compact space, and as I'm sure you all know, that's the sum of antisymmetric tensors in the compact space. And so these are the things, those of you who do know string theory will recognize these MIJs as what we call rack brain charges in string theory. They're things that correspond to In the simplest cases, they correspond to the number of D-brains of various kinds that are wrapped around topological cycles of the manifold. So it's our contention that the structure of this algebra, which I haven't filled out for you, I haven't told you how the M's commute with each other or how they commute with the S's, we contend that the structure of this algebra will contain everything that string theory allows you to say about the topology and geometry of the internal manifold. It's well known to string theorists that many properties of the internal manifold are, like its dimension, the number of cycles of various kinds, are not invariant under what we call string dualities. But the things that are invariant are the things that appear on the right-hand side of this algebra. Those of you who know string theory will also recognize that what this algebra is the light cone supersymmetry algebra. All right, this is the light cone piece of the supersymmetry algebra where what's sitting on the right-hand side are the brain charges. And indeed, in various constructions that we've made, which are supposed to represent asymptotically flat space times, these things become, or linear combinations of these objects, become the supersymmetry charges of the theory. This is a claim that the holographic approach to space-time physics automatically incorporates the idea of supersymmetry. The natural variables that appear in the holographic approach are the variables that are connected with supersymmetry, and we believe it will be impossible to construct a formulation of this theory in asymptotically flat space, which is not exactly supersymmetric. Okay, I just want to say one more word about this notion of pixel. The thing that you think of is you think of little squares. Well, I'm going to have you think of that in a more abstract way. You can think of that by saying, let's take the algebra of functions on the holographic screen and replace it by a finite dimensional algebra whose basis consists of functions that are one on each pixel and zero every place else. And then do that for all the different pixels covering the screen. And so the essential point is that I have a function algebra, which is a finite dimensional algebra. A more general notion of pixelation is to choose a non-commutative algebra with finite dimensions. And when you do that, you can very easily have the property that as you make the algebra bigger and bigger, it becomes commutative. Those of you who know anything about fuzzy spheres will know that this is a standard procedure in non-commutative geometry. And so we have found that the most efficient way to think about pixels is in terms of a non-commutative pixelization of the screen. Yeah?
You motivated the string theory, but could you take another finite dimension?
We don't yet know. This is very much work in progress and very few people working on it. What we have constructed in published work, what I have constructed in published work, is the version that gives rise in the limit to 11-dimensional supergravity in non-compact space. I also know how to do 11-dimensional supergravity compactified on the torus, and I have ideas about how to do compactifications on Calabi-Yau manifolds and so on, but those haven't been worked out. So the general rules, I don't know. This is something that's still to be done in this. Okay.
Now, let me show you a couple of more pictures that tries to illustrate what I meant by this index n. So I'm going to do that by talking about two very different kinds of spacetimes. And one of the things that's also built into this formalism is that different kinds of asymptotic boundaries in spacetime get built out of the same ingredients, but you can see very clearly that you want to treat them differently and to make a mapping between the geometry and the quantum algebra in a rather different way. So for example, if I have an asymptotically flat spacetime, then the way to think about this index n is the following. You imagine the trajectory of some observer, some time-like observer. And then you start out on some little interval of the trajectory, and you make a little causal diamond between two points on the trajectory. Then you go out a little bit further into both the past and the future. Why both? Because we're dealing with a TCP symmetric spacetime. And so it's reasonable to try to build a formalism that always uses those causal diamonds. One of the things I should point out to all of you who know about general relativity and diffeomorphism invariance, we are going to be talking here about the spacetime as seen from the point of view of certain privileged observers. This is quantum mechanics without extra degrees of freedom, so it corresponds to a fixed gauge for diffeomorphisms. And I'll be implicitly defining what that gauge is for my cosmological spacetime. I'll tell you about it in a little while. Here, I'm doing a rather different gauge fixing. But you basically map out the trajectory of a geodesic observer in asymptotically flat spacetime by looking at it as a nested sequence of larger and larger causal diamonds. Okay? And you have to have some kind of dynamical principle that takes you from the past boundary of each causal diamond to its future boundary, and some relationship between the dynamics in this causal diamond and that causal diamond. I want to emphasize to you what a picture like this means in terms of quantum mechanics is that there's a tensor factor of the algebra corresponding to this little causal diamond in the algebra that describes the big causal diamond. And you have to make dynamical rules such that in order to propagate only within a smaller causal diamond, your rules, your Hamiltonian or your scattering matrix, only involve the degrees of freedom in that diamond. Okay? The others have to be decoupled. Well, I'm taking them nested for two reasons. Number one, what you want to do is actually take them, start off with a very small one that has the minimal possible entropy, so the minimal single pixel Hilbert space, and then increase the entropy each time you go up. Okay? So they get bigger and bigger. Each one is inside the other. Okay? Are you complaining about the symmetric nesting? Yes, yes, I indeed agree. Yeah, right. Right, but I think it is most appropriate dynamically. Remember, this is like choosing a particular observer in a particular gauge. I think it's for an asymptotically flat spacetime with all of the symmetry that we expect it to have, it's most natural to take a very symmetric nesting like this one. For cosmology, we think about something rather different. Namely, for cosmology, you would imagine that all of the diamonds should be started, I should make a confession, I mean Big Bang cosmology. So there's a beginning of time. What does that mean? I think of all of the diamonds as having the same endpoint. My drawing program didn't quite do that for me, but you should think of these all as having the same endpoint. And then I told you about the spatial lattice. Here are two points on the spatial lattice. I didn't want to draw more in order not to mess things up beyond all recognition. But you've got two different points. And each of the diamonds here, for a single observer, correspond to a longer and longer piece of that observer's trajectory up from the Big Bang. And same thing for this observer over here. And now I'm going to tell you what gauge I'm choosing for the slicing. I'm choosing a gauge for the slicing such that, first of all, if the definition of what I mean by nearest neighbors on this lattice is that the overlap at any point n, well, first let me say, at any point n at either of the lattice points, at any point n, I've got the same entropy. So this is, you've drawn your constant time surfaces so that the area of the causal diamond that goes back from that point to the Big Bang is the same at each spatial point. Okay, that's a definition of the time slicing. And then my definition of what I mean by nearest neighbor on the lattice is that at a fixed time, the overlap between the two nearest neighbor causal diamonds is missing precisely one pixel. Okay? It's got everything but one pixel. Now, I have to also, in order to make a fully realized theory, I have to specify, and this is part of the dynamics, I have to specify all the other overlaps between all the different possible causal diamonds. And furthermore, if I start telling you about the dynamical evolution of this system, I have to specify it in a way that it's all consistent. So that if I have some overlap, that the dynamics that's imposed on that overlap by the Hamiltonian in causal diamond 1 is the same as that imposed on it by the dynamics in causal diamond 2. That's a huge set, perhaps infinite, if this lattice is infinite or if I let things go on for infinite time. It's a huge set, at least perhaps an infinite set, of complicated dynamical consistency conditions. In fact, we've only found one actual solution to all of those conditions. We think that they are so stringent that it might be that that's all you need to define what you mean by a holographic spacetime, but I can't prove that to you. And the one solution we found is something called holographic cosmology. This is work, the mathematical work on this was done in a paper by myself, Willie Fischler, and Lorenzo Manelli, a former student of mine. And we heuristically call it the dense black hole fluid. What we did was we found a consistent set of solutions for overlaps and Hamiltonians for all of the different causal diamonds in a Big Bang space-time, with the property that, first of all, the Hamiltonian was forced to be the same at every point on the lattice, but was a time-dependent Hamiltonian. And as time goes on, it is basically chosen at each time independently from a certain random distribution of Hamiltonians. If you do that and use things about large matrices, large Hamiltonians, you can show that within our class of Hamiltonians, the system in the very large area limit obeys all of the scaling laws you would expect if this was a flat FRW universe, homogeneous, isotropic, flat, with equation of state p equals rho for the matter. All right? The equation of state p equals rho can be understood heuristically in the following way. First of all, Fischler and Susskind had shown that that's the equation of state for which, if you saturate the holographic bound at any given time, it remains saturated forever, both into the past and the future. Secondly, you can model it in the following way. Take black holes and just heuristically put them a distance that's of order a Schwarzschild radius apart and calculate the entropy density and the energy density according to the usual formulas. You then find a relation that the entropy density goes like the square root of the energy density, okay? That just follows by just writing down the entropy. Now, imagine a set of black holes which are such that there, if I look at a given particle horizon volume, a given causal diamond, I've got a black hole that sort of fills up the whole horizon. And now, as the universe expands, the black holes merge, okay? Then in such a way that they still look like they have the same equation relating entropy density and energy density, then you can show that the equation of state of that fluid is p equals rho. It's the maximally stiff fluid. Any stiffer fluid would have a speed of light greater than the speed of sound. Okay? Now, there is another way to get p equals rho from homogeneous scalar fields. But that's a system that has zero entropy density. And so it's not at all the same thing. They satisfy the Friedmann equations for a P equals rho fluid. Sorry? Yes. The pressure is when they merge, they want to grow. Yeah. That's that. Look, take for yourself the laws of thermodynamics and the relation between energy density and entropy density that is given by a set of black holes. And just imagine that that's stationary and gives you an equation of state. You can then calculate from thermodynamics what the pressure to energy density relation is. It's P equals rho. That picture, of course, is only supposed to be heuristic. We have a real mathematical model that does that. And the geometric properties of the model are emergent. We can show how to define the geometry in terms of things that we calculate in the quantum mechanical system. Okay, now that's as far as we've gotten as far as actual mathematical models. Willy Fischler and I actually, slightly before we found this mathematical model, we had the idea of the dense black hole fluid. And on the basis of that idea, we invented a quasi-realistic model of cosmology. And the quasi-realistic model is based on the idea of a defect in this dense black hole fluid. So this dense black hole fluid is very nice. You have a very nice mathematical formalism for it, but you wouldn't want to live there. Why wouldn't you want to live there? Because at every point in space-time, every degree of freedom is in thermal equilibrium with every other degree of freedom all the time. Okay? So you can't actually live there because life requires increase of entropy, and you would just be part of the degrees of freedom in a black hole. So we tried to imagine taking a mess like that and embedding a hole in it where physics was somewhat more normal. And then you can do the following interesting exercise. Take a spherical hole and put on the inside an FRW universe with some equation of state that you like radiation-dominated, matter-dominated, it doesn't matter what. The only one which will be special will be P equals minus rho de Sitter space. I'll come back to that in a minute. But if I take a sphere like that, and I embed it in an infinite P equals rho FRW universe. And now I impose the Israel junction conditions on the boundary. Then the condition that the geometry on the boundary agrees on both sides for all time shows you that the coordinate volume of the normal region has to shrink. This is true for every equation of state with P between less than 1 and greater than minus 1. For P equals minus rho de Sitter space, it turns out you can do something slightly different. Instead of putting a fixed FRW coordinate sphere into contact with the P equals rho boundary, take the horizon the cosmological horizon of de Sitter space. Take one maximal causal diamond in de Sitter space. Its horizon is a marginally trapped surface. You know that you can embed a marginally trapped surface into any background FRW spacetime because that's just what a black hole is. So you can embed a de Sitter universe into the interior of a black hole, and all the Israel junction conditions are satisfied. So that's okay for P equals minus rho. For any other value of P less than 1, if you try to put a sphere of normal stuff inside, it shrinks. Yeah? Sorry?
Is that configuration of the Sitter inside the black hole stable towards calculations of the black hole?
I'll tell you why we think it's stable. We have not actually done a dynamical calculation. The reason we think it's stable is because both of the systems are maximizing the entropy on that surface.
Okay, so there's no way to gain more entropy by distorting the surface in some fashion. Anything you do will make the entropy go down. We don't have a, we haven't done a more rigorous analysis of that then within GR. You could probably do it, but we have not.
So our cosmological constant comes about because we're the inside of one of these things?
Yep. Okay. So first of all, before we get to that asymptotic De Sitter space, you also don't want to live in De Sitter space because it's empty. All right, so we want to have a real normal universe. So imagine doing the following thing. I take what will eventually become the horizon volume, the horizon coordinate volume of our normal universe, and I want to somehow inside of that stick in some normal region. But I can't just put a big sphere, okay, because I'd have to make that sphere much bigger than our actual coordinate horizon volume because it would have to shrink. Now, one of the things that I'm doing, one of my principles, which David may object to philosophically, is I'm trying to find initial conditions that maximize the entropy. Now, I've already found them. The P equals rho fluid saturates the holographic bound at all times. So if I do anything else, I won't be maximizing the entropy, but I want to maximize the entropy subject to the condition that I can live there. All right, so I want to have some relatively normal region. And so what we imagine is between filling up the whole region with normal stuff and not filling it at all, there's some intermediate configuration whose shape we have no idea of, but here's a possibility. So this is little balls of normal region tied together in such a way that they support each other and don't let the black hole fluid squeeze them in. Okay? And I have no idea what the real optimal shape of such a configuration is, but there has to be something that maximizes the entropy. That is to say, it starts out with a minimum volume of this normal stuff, but still survives. Now, we don't know what that is, but let's start with that. Okay? So that's our starting configuration, a defect in the P equals rho universe. Now, the properties of this defect model are the following. First of all, there is what we call a transition between a defect in the dense black hole fluid and a dilute black hole gas. On these time slices that I've defined, the time slices of equal area back to the Big Bang, if I take an inhomogeneous universe, which in some region is normal, say radiation dominated, and in some other region has the equation of state P equals rho, you can now, in a well-defined way, ask what happens to the relative volume of the normal region compared to the black hole, the P equals rho region. Answer, and this is just solving Einstein's equations, in the two cases with this condition that the times are related by having the areas be equal, you find this. The normal region grows in volume with respect to the black hole region. And you end up with a picture such that wherever there was a normal thing before, most of the volume is covered by normal region, except for some little things in the interstices. Now, what are these things in the interstices? These are things that locally maximize the entropy. And so they behave like black holes floating around in a normal region. In other words, like a dilute black hole gas. Intersect. Well, I've defined this in terms of gluing together a bunch of spheres in order to make nice pictures. That's just an artist's license, okay? This region, the normal regions crash into each other? Yeah, I think in a more exact formulation of this theory, you would have to, you'd have to have a much more mathematical formulation of what's going on. This would correspond to what's going on in the Hilbert spaces on different lattice sites in that. And I
if I knew how to formulate it for you that way, I would, but I really don't know much more but heuristics about this. Yes?
Forgetting how much maybe you've evolved on this, but I'm trying to understand to what extent this is a steady state picture and to what extent the original black hole gas is some kind of equilibrium.
Okay, so the original black hole gas for sure was a complete equilibrium.
But you've just showed it's unstable.
No. No, we haven't done that at all. Okay, what we've shown is that there's a sufficiently large deviation from it, this complicated mess of normal region, which is stable against recollapse. And we're going to find that actually we have to put some further conditions on in order for it to be stable. Okay?
You're going to talk more about that.
I'm going to talk more about that in a minute. Okay. So you have to understand this initial configuration that I sketched, that one, there we go. This thing is some huge deviation over a very large region, this very complicated, large thing. It's as small as it can be and still not collapse into the black hole fluid, but it still has to be thought of as a big fluctuation away from what would have been the equilibrium situation.
Okay, but you want me to wait before asking more questions?
That might be helpful.
Why don't I do that?
Okay.
Can I ask a very naive question?
Yeah.
So even your earlier statement that if I have normal stuff surrounded by D equals rho stuff, let's forget that they're black holes, it's just D equals rho. Why do you say the normal stuff will lose out?
If you just solve the Israel junction condition. Solve the condition.
I have a constant energy density on my slides, but yes. Just have a different pressure. Let's say negative pressure within a batch, but P equals rho. So okay. I would have thought the negative pressure guy wins out.
No. Okay. If you look at in FRW coordinates, okay, take a sphere of your FRW stuff, starting at some coordinate radius. And now I'm going to match that, having one kind of FRW inside and P equals rho FRW outside. Okay? Match those two together using the Israel condition that the surface be the same surface on both sides. What you find is that in order to satisfy that condition, the coordinate volume of the inside has to shrink.
Okay.
That's right. Okay. Now, and again, for P equals minus rho, the maximally negative pressure in a different coordinate system, you avoid that by putting in this marginally cross surface. Okay? Okay. Extremely importantly, I think that there's an argument here for homogeneity and isotropy that's completely independent of inflation. We haven't said anything about inflation up to this point. Why is that? First of all, I derive the P equals rho fluid. It's a real system. I've given it generic initial conditions, and it obeys the rules of flat FRW spacetime. It's homogeneous and isotropic, okay, despite the fact that I started from a generic initial condition. Now I'm making this deviation from it, which obviously destroys the homogeneity and isotropy. I put this complicated shape into it. But remember what I told you about how to think about that shape after this transition occurs. It's a normal region with a bunch of black holes in it. Now, that if I think about the distribution of those black holes in their positions and their velocities, if there are large inhomogeneous fluctuations in either the positions or the velocities, the black holes are going to tend to collide and coalesce. And so the system will be, for sufficiently large inhomogeneity, very unstable into recollapse into the dense black hole fluid, okay, into a situation which maximizes the entropy every place. So there's some bound that says you can't be more inhomogeneous than this. I can't, at this stage, be more quantitative than that. I will not consider this completely satisfactory unless, for example, we could derive the 10 to the minus 5 in delta rho over rho from these kinds of considerations, which we don't yet know how to do. Okay. So there is a plausible explanation of homogeneity and isotropy, maybe not as much as we know we need experimentally, but some degree of homogeneity and isotropy from things that have nothing whatsoever to do with inflation. This does two things. Number one, it sets up initial conditions where inflation is allowed if you have an appropriate scalar field. That is to say, if that scalar field has sufficiently inhomogeneous initial values, again, it will lead to recollapse into the dense black hole fluid. So it has to be fairly homogeneous. And Andy has talked a lot about the fine-tuning of initial conditions that are necessary for inflation or not. I believe they are fine-tuned. But in this model, they might not be fine-tuned. Notice that since you've solved the homogeneity, isotropy, and flatness problems without recourse to inflation, the only thing you really need inflation for in this model is to explain the fact that we see correlations on the sky over regions that we might have thought were causally disconnected. You only need 20 E-foldings or 25 E-foldings of inflation in order to explain the CMD. Okay, the 60 is in order to have a homogeneity and isotropy explained by inflation starting at the gut era. Okay, good. All right. So there are two possibilities in this model. So as I said, we do need inflation for something. So there's going to be inflation. That inflation might be the origin of the scale invariant spectrum with its tilt. For reasons that I'll discuss in a moment, this has to happen at rather low scales, below the Planck scale. So it's probable that that inflation model is not one of your vanilla single field slow roll models, but something more complicated like hybrid inflation. But there's another source that we found in this model for scale invariant fluctuations. That is to say, the initial conditions in this model are inhomogeneous. What we showed is if you take that inhomogeneity and process it through the P equals rho era, you get a spectrum of fluctuations which are scale invariant with two cutoffs. And the two cutoffs are the horizon size at the time that this transition to the dilute black hole gas takes place on the long wavelength end, and the Planck scale at that time on the short wavelength end. And the Planck scale, I'm sorry, not the Planck scale at that time. Okay, so that's a range over which you get approximately scale invariant fluctuation. Now, whether it's complicated with normal inflation models, this will give rise to fluctuations in the inflaton field because inflation kicks in when the inflaton energy density becomes bigger than the local density of these black holes, and that will depend on these initial fluctuations. So these will be non-quantum fluctuations of the inflaton field, but fluctuations in its initial conditions due to the primordial soup of black holes. Whether that can be processed in a normal inflation model, if you process that through, you can't get a red tilt out of the spectrum. We've been playing with some models with a student that might be able to get a red tilt out of that spectrum. If that doesn't work, then for sure I would say that the fluctuations come from this shorter period of inflation.
We only observe 20 EFOs in the CMD and large scale structure, but those loads exited the horizon, you know, 60 EFOs ago.
No, only because you insisted that you had to have 60 EFOs of inflation in order to solve the flatness and homogeneity.
Very low scale inflation.
That's right. Oh. We're going to have low scale inflation, and it's just not necessary.
Any predictions for the tensor modes?
It's what it looks to us so far is that the tensor mode should be zero.
It was a prediction, right?
Yes, I think
So this other mechanism you're describing in inhomogeneities, would that lead to a nearly Gaussian spectrum?
Okay, we do not have a good argument. We can, without further knowledge of sort of the shape of this initial object or the distribution of shapes that are allowable, I can't give you an argument that it's Gaussian or not Gaussian. We tried to cook one up, but so far we don't have one. So that's another possible problem with trying to use these primordial fluctuations as what we see in the sky and the CMB. And we don't know the answer. You can make a model in which you lay these balls down with a Gaussian probability distribution that gives rise to a Gaussian fluctuation spectrum. But that's not necessarily the right way to do it. And we don't know what the real physics would imply. Okay. So I've now explained everything I said on that transparency. Now,
wait a minute, the entropy, is that because we're living in the universe? Is that the reason it's low?
No. The entropy in the usual way will come from the entropy, why the initial entropy is low? The initial entropy is low because we had to avoid falling into this dense black hole fluid. So the basic idea is that maximal entropy initial conditions, or anything close to that, will be this dense black hole fluid. That's a very stable phase. You need to have a big low entropy fluctuation away from that in order to get any normal region at all.
Okay. Why does it have to be so big?
Sorry?
Why does it have to be so big? Such a big departure.
Okay. So I think is probably going to come through the actual size of this region is determined by the eventual cosmological constant. So the size of this region by the holographic principle is determined really by the number of initial degrees of freedom that you pulled out of equilibrium in this way.
Okay.
And that number, that's an initial condition, which eventually will determine what the maximal size causal diamond is. This thing, in order to be stable, eventually it's going to homogenize more or less, and it has to become de Sitter space. Otherwise, as I told you, it recollapses. In order for that to happen, you get some cosmological constant, but what determines that cosmological constant is my decision to choose initial conditions of a type that where enough degrees of freedom are out of equilibrium.
That's related to your 20 E folding times.
No. That has nothing to do with the 20 E folding times. Okay? No, that has to do with the final cosmological constant, not previous inflation. If I didn't have inflation and I had a cosmological constant, the cosmological horizon would end up being the same thing.
But the short period inflation does deliver a moderately low entropy universe. The inflation smooths things out.
Well, I would claim that that's put in. We can discuss that later. I think that that's the claim that explains the low entropy is a
well, no, it's like as you go back a step.
Not even in this model, just in general. You're assuming things about degrees of freedom outside the horizon when you make the statement that you just made, and you've really, I claim, put in the low entropy assumption.
Well, I don't disagree.
In the standard,
it's only in your model you have that.
In our model, that low entropy assumption comes out of something else.
Right.
Okay. Now let me return to this point that I have to, in order to eventually end up in a stable state that doesn't collapse, I have to end up in de Sitter space. As I've just been discussing, the cosmological constant of that de Sitter space was an initial value. It was an input that where I determined by hand how big this eventual region was going to be, how many degrees of freedom were not in equilibrium. And you can think now at this point what you want to do. So, one possibility would be to say, look, this is a theory of the universe. The maximal entropy thing that I can do is say this happened once. And it happened one time, and I it chose the value that gave rise to the cosmological constant we see. We don't discuss it anymore beyond the fact that we know that if it had been drastically different, we wouldn't be here to see it. Okay? Or you can invoke a multiverse. That is to say, you can have lots of little patches in various parts. Imagine an infinite P equals rho universe, which is in fact mathematically what we constructed. We didn't have boundaries to that universe. An infinite P equals rho universe. And over here, there's a little patch, which I start off with a normal ticker toy region. And over there, there's another little patch. And each of those grows up, becomes a universe or not, I mean, a universe with people in it or not, depending on its cosmological constant, among other things. And those things never interact with each other. They're far away. They're in this expanding P equals rho gas. It's their density. If they don't have a uniform density, there's no reason for them to be to dominate the universe eventually and collide with each other. So this is what I call the lonely multiverse. And I could get, in this way, a distribution of cosmological constants, which would then allow me to do anthropic selection. And you can choose whether you like that better than just picking the initial condition by hand. Okay? One way or another, we live with a value of the cosmological constant, and our real understanding of why that value is because if the value was drastically different from that, the world would be sufficiently different that we wouldn't be here to live in it. By the way, in this framework, there are lots of additional bounds on the cosmological constant that have to do with the relation to supersymmetry, which I do want to get to. Yeah, there was a question.
Yeah, so why do you say they don't interact? Are you assuming there is no
gravitational? Well, they interact through gravitational forces.
Okay, so there is a graviton exchange.
So there's graviton exchange. They attract each other, but they're in an expanding universe. And unless I assume maliciously that I have a uniform density of these things, in which case they will eventually dominate the energy density, then they would eventually collide, and God knows how to think about that. There's no necessity for doing that. I can easily have enough of them to do anthropic selection on without having an infinite number of them spread throughout the infinite universe. Okay, so you just have to, I don't know, right? These kinds of questions are questions that I don't know how to answer because they don't seem to have any effect on physics in our universe until unimaginably long times in the future. And so perhaps you could get out of this model that predicts that it's some unimaginably long time in the future, probably long after De Sitter space has become empty, that these things collide and new interesting stuff happens, but I don't suspect that you can get really interesting, complicated stuff out of it. It will be just like black holes colliding. Okay. So now I want to tell you, well, I've actually run my time out a little too much, so I can come back to this if you want. There are a couple of other things that I want to talk about first. First of all, there's a question of what kind of theory the theory of a De Sitter space of the type I'm talking about should be. So there are a couple of things which, for details, I'm going to have to refer you to this paper I wrote with Tomeo Fiol and Alex Maurice. We contend there that if I think of a De Sitter space, which really is a system with a finite number of states, and a system with a finite number of states by definition is stable, okay? And the De Sitter space, especially once you learn that what we call empty De Sitter space is just a generic state in the Hilbert space. It has all of the entropy of the full Hilbert space. So it's stable,
And now you ask yourself, we argue along the kinds of arguments that I started talking about here, that in the limit that the cosmological constant goes to zero, it will become not just Poincaré invariant, but super Poincaré invariant. So it will become a supersymmetric theory. And you ask yourself what kind of low energy effective physics you could have in that theory. And the answer is that the low energy physics should be described by a field theory. And you have to fine tune the cosmological constant in that field theory. The fine tuning can be done in supergravity by tuning a parameter called W naught, the constant in the superpotential. We can always do that. In this framework, it's what you should do, because that's just a low energy theory. I told you that the actual thing that determines the cosmological constant is the number of states in the Hilbert space of quantum gravity. The low energy theory doesn't know anything about that. It thinks it has an infinite number of states. So you have to put the cosmological constant in by hand, and you do when you do it in the way we know how to do. And the limit should be a system with R symmetry and W equals zero. And furthermore, at finite values of the cosmological constant, it should be stable. Now, the number of systems like that that we know about in string theory, even including all of the hypothetical states that people have talked about in the landscape, is precisely zero. Okay? Because in all of the hypothetical states that have been talked about in the landscape, there is a field theory at low energy. It has a de Sitter minimum, local. But then there's another region of field space where the cosmological constant goes to zero. And now I claim that that situation is one in which the de Sitter space decays. And Coleman and DeLucia tell us how to calculate its decay rate. And there's no finite number of states, because the thing it decays into out at infinity is a system in locally asymptotically flat space, and it doesn't have a finite number of states. Okay? So what could be going on? So none of the landscape states correspond to low energy approximations to the kind of model I'm proposing here. Not a single one of them. That is to say, all the work in string theory has not succeeded in finding such a state. So now let me talk a little bit about metastability, because this is something that most people don't know, even though it's actually been in the literature since the paper of Coleman and DeLucia in 1981, more or less.
You mean not yet found?
Or sorry?
Will never be found.
All the ones yet found. Right. Okay. I can argue to you that with present methods, it will never be found. But we can discuss what present methods.
Because you don't like the present methods.
Well, no. The present methods are based on having this asymptotic region where the thing becomes supersymmetric. So they can't ever find a state that doesn't have such a region. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about just the Coleman and DeLucia gravitational tunneling story. If you take a general potential, the lowest de Sitter minimum in that potential is unstable for sure in either of the following two conditions. Either there's a V equals zero region someplace, perhaps out at infinity, or when I dial parameters such that that lowest de Sitter minimum goes down to zero, the Coleman-DeLucia instanton persists, and the so-called asymptotically flat space that you appear to get in that limit actually decays into something else. Those are instabilities. However, if that is not the case, and it's always not the case if when you take the limit as the cosmological constant goes to zero, the flat space you get is supersymmetric, then the instanton is never there. Then you find that the decay probability for any decay of de Sitter space to negative cosmological constant, it also fluctuates up to higher positive cosmological constant by a tunneling, all of those decays have the property that they're suppressed
by the probability is suppressed by e to the minus the entropy of De Sitter space. And that, in the case of two De Sitter minima, you can actually calculate both the back and forth rates, and they're related by the detailed balance. That is, the ratio between the back and forth rates is e to the minus the difference between the entropies. This has the signature of a system with a finite number of states, and what we're calling a decay, even in the case where the decay is into a negative cosmological constant Big Crunch, is something that, as far as probability is concerned, looks like a temporary sojourn in a low entropy state. And if you believe that there's a quantum theory, a unitary quantum theory associated with this, there must be a backward transition amplitude that is much faster. Okay? The decay is suppressed by e to the minus the entropy because there are many more states in the system that look like the empty De Sitter vacuum than look like either the higher De Sitter vacuum or the negative CC Big Crunches that you get. The holographic principle actually gives additional evidence for this, because if you look in the negative CC Big Crunch universes at the maximal entropy that any observer in such a universe could actually measure by looking at the maximal size of his causal diamond, it is microscopically small. And so my claim is that all the evidence of tunneling is that some systems in which we say De Sitter space decays actually don't correspond to instabilities, but rather to these sort of low entropy fluctuations, like the air piling up in the corner of the room. And there's something that we shouldn't worry about. And they're totally consistent with the picture of this De Sitter space as a system with a finite number of states. And in fact, they give additional evidence for it.
See, I'm a little confused. We started out by saying that we weren't going to have big fluctuations in space-time.
Yes.
And when we wind up talking about tunneling the whole universe, which appears to me to be a sort of quantum mechanical process, are we sort of consistent on the whole?
I think that the correct quantum mechanical description of those things has to be other than the Coleman-DeLucia process. Okay. So that's all I have to say.
Okay. I think it might carry over. Are you expecting it'll carry over more or less the same?
Sorry?
It'll look pretty much like Coleman-DeLucia?
Well, I can't tell you what it'll look like to the person who happens to be there when that terrible fluctuation occurs and Coleman-DeLucia says that he undergoes a big crunch in a microscopic timescale. He or she, excuse me, undergoes a big crunch in the microscopic timescale. It's a bit artificial, in fact, to even contemplate those things. Typically, you would imagine that everything except the very low cosmological constant scale is sort of on the string scale. Mm-hmm. Okay, so. I mean, certainly, or maybe the Susie breaking scale or something like that. So certainly thinking about a person falling into that region makes no sense at all. Okay. So I think there's some more proper quantum mechanical description of it. In a system with a finite number of states, it's very possible to have these kinds of crazy transitions to low entropy states. And the space-time description that Coleman-DeLucia gives certainly breaks down in a very short amount of time, so I think there's a proper quantum mechanical description that replaces it. Okay, how much more time do I have?
We've got another 20 minutes for questions as well.
Okay. Let's see. Okay, I'm going to skip over all of my conclusions except the last one, okay? Because they're just repeating all the things that I've said, and I said plenty about them. You can ask me about them if you are confused still, which I'm sure many of you are, given the maladroit way in which I tried to explain it. There are One other point that I want to make is the way in which field theory comes out of this story. And for that, I have to go back a couple of slides. What I told you is we're going to describe the holographic screen of a causal diamond in terms of pixels. And the pixels are going to be described as basis elements in the non-commutative, quote, algebra of functions. But it's a finite dimensional algebra, so it's just a matrix algebra. So I can think of all of my variables, these S variables that I told you about, instead of thinking of them as S of n's, where n labels which basis element, you're thinking about multiply it by the correct basis element in the space of matrices, and S becomes a matrix. Okay, so I have these spinner variables, which also have matrix labels. Okay? Now, in the paper with Piol and Maurice, what we showed is the following thing. These things are, it turns out they're not exactly, they're really a bundle over the algebra of functions, so they're n by, in that case, n plus 1 matrices. It doesn't matter, they're n by m matrices with m of order n. And what we showed is that in the limit where n gets very large, if you restrict attention to matrices that are approximately block diagonal, okay, where there are, you allow yourself lots of blocks, and in addition to lots of blocks, each block has lots of size to it, then you can show that the degrees of freedom defined by our algebra in simple cases of the algebra that we know how to handle, the degrees of freedom become the variables of particles going through the holographic screen. So the matrix label essentially becomes a label that's telling you about functions on the holographic screen, or pick now good old-fashioned pixel functions in the limit, and they tell you about a little region on the holographic screen that the particle is going through. The rest of the degrees of freedom become the spin degrees of freedom of a superparticle. Okay? And so they become supersymmetric particles penetrating, massless supersymmetric particles penetrating out through the holographic screen. And you get a lot of them with particle statistics, because you have block diagonal matrices and there's a permutation symmetry between the matrices. A few of you may know the work that I did more than 10 years ago now on matrix theory with Susskind and Fischler and Schenker. And that's the paradigm for this. The permutation statistics of block diagonal matrices in that theory became the particle statistics, Bose or Fermi statistics. The fact that the fundamental variables are anti-commuting spinners gave you the proper spin statistics connection. And the same thing happens in our description of de Sitter space. Now, what that tells you is the following thing. Number one, that in order to get the way field theory is approximated in a theory like this is not as any kind of field theory whatsoever. It's as a particle theory with a finite number of particles. And furthermore, each particle only has a finite number of its angular momentum states on the holographic screen. And in order to have a good approximation by a theory of particles with a fixed cosmological constant, you have to have a small number of particles, but each of them having a large enough number of variables that it can sort of go out anywhere you want on the holographic screen. You have to be able to localize it. And the optimum is to take n to the 3/2, n to the 1/2 size blocks, and there are n of them, so you get n to the 3/2 degrees of freedom or entropy. That's compared to the n squared you would expect. All of this counting is for four-dimensional non-compact spacetime. That's what you would get out of this formalism. That coincides with the following little exercise you can do
in field theory. Take field theory, put it inside a box of order the horizon size, maximize the entropy of states in that field theory subject to the constraint that you don't form a horizon-sized black hole. And the answer is you get entropy that scales like the radius to the 3/2 rather than the radius squared, which is the total entropy of De Sitter space. So what this says is in one of these holographic theories, most of the degrees of freedom associated with a given holographic screen cannot be thought of as particle variables in that space-time region. When there are too many of them or they have too many states apiece, instead, they all interact together. You can't separate the particles. And in our paper, we also suggested a way in which you could get a description of them, which would be a description of a black hole state, basically an equilibrium state for all of the degrees of freedom. So the general lesson is nothing here said anything about the total entropy, the total energy density in the space-time region in a cosmological theory being low or high compared to the Planck mass. Even when things are low energy compared to the Planck mass, you can't think about these theories as field theories. And some field theoretic intuitions are wrong. And that's my final piece of advice about how this framework will reduce to quantum field theory. You shouldn't push quantum field theory too hard. Our usual prejudices about when it's right are wrong in this specific theory. Thank you.
Following up a bit more on the big picture piece of this. So we have this black hole gas, and that's somehow the most fundamental thing. So this equilibrium, are we imagining it kind of, well, we're not imagining it persists forever because there's an initial singularity.
No. There's no initial singularity
no,
whatsoever in this form.
So you've lined it, right? That picture was just how you define time.
Yeah. The P equals, there's not initial singularity. What happens is, if I go back far enough in time that there aren't very many degrees of freedom in a causal diamond, then the scaling laws break down. So the description of the system as a P equals rho FRW is not right any longer.
So in fact, all you have is something. You
have tiny amounts of numbers of degrees of freedom interacting with each other. So in this system, the reason you stop at a finite point is because you have a time-dependent Hamiltonian, which is such that at the initial time, it doesn't couple the degrees of freedom associated with the causal diamond to anything else. And you can't go back any further because going back always means reducing the number of degrees of freedom. There are no more to reduce. And so then at each step, as you go up that tower, you let more and more degrees of freedom interact. There's a time asymmetry built into the formalism. It doesn't explain, however, by itself the thermodynamic error of time. But there is a time asymmetry built into the formalism in this, because of this idea that you let causal diamonds with finite numbers of degrees of freedom only interact with themselves up until the time when the diamond has grown and incorporated more degrees of freedom.
But you still have some notion that that's sitting there forever, or you don't care because it doesn't.
Well, if I.
What I'm trying to do, to show you, my feeling is that the fundamental definition of equilibrium is if you let something sit there forever. Mm-hmm. That's what it looks like.
Right.
And I'm trying to fit that in with the fact that you have something funny at the beginning. And also you have this instability, even though you said, I think all you said is that it's a rare instability, but it's still an instability into the future where you go to the De Sitter.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I just kind of put that into a big picture.
Okay. So two things about that. First of all, we're talking about a situation with time-dependent Hamiltonians, absolutely necessarily in this framework.
That's how you've set it up.
Because of the fact that I don't allow the Hamiltonian to couple degrees of freedom in this causal diamond with the rest of the degrees of freedom until the next step or the next step or whichever.
Yeah, this whole structure that has
time. So the whole structure has time dependence in it. So what you've got is some time dependent steady state rather than a thermodynamic equilibrium with a fixed time independent Hamiltonian. That's what the dense black hole
is. So it's sort of not, it's not a true equilibrium in the sense I just described, in the sense there's this whole time structure.
That's right.
And but there's sort of an equilibrium in the sense that there's some time scale in which it's pretty stable.
The sense in which it's equilibrium is that as you go up, the prescription by which it's defined remains the same, except that you add more degrees of freedom. And then if you go up far enough, you get to a scaling regime where everything, every coarse grain thing, looks the same at each stage up to some scaling level.
Okay.
And that's the regime in which the P equals rho fluid description comes in. This is also one of the reasons that I think that you can't get out of this until you go way lower than the Planck scale, because the Planck scale was down here at that first tiny causal diamond. You don't even get the P equals rho description until quite a bit later when this large N approximation becomes good. All right. And then in our picture, all right, it takes even longer than that until the defect
has a chance to
grow and make the black hole gas transit to a dilute gas.
So you really put this very concrete structure in time, and that's driven by causality as a concept. It's just that this is such an essential feature.
So the first question we have in our minds, which we think this formalism solves, is, well, you've got this crazy holographic idea which looks totally non-local. How am I going to get causality in such a theory? Answer, here's the way to do it.
So reconciling holography is sort of putting causality on an equal footing with holography is a deep fundamental principle. It's forced you to do something with time.
That's what we do.
That sort of denies
till
the
we put
of
in the
deepest concept of equilibrium.
That's right. So we put in the idea of particle horizon, which you usually think of as deriving from local field theory. We put that in as part of the structure.
Okay.
Okay. So in the usual picture, in the conventional picture of field theory, so I associate a Hilbert space to a regional space at a given time, and I have a product structure of Hilbert spaces whenever I consider more regions on the same time slicing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's your theory of tensor product structure of Hilbert spaces in your picture?
So the basic idea is, let me draw some pictures, okay? So you'll excuse me for not drawing diamonds. So you imagine putting down some structure of diamonds, tiling, over-tiling space-time with all kinds of intersections, okay? And then you start making rules. And you start saying, this diamond overlaps with this diamond in a Hilbert space of a certain dimension. That is to say, there's a tensor factor in the Hilbert space associated with this diamond and this diamond, which is common to both of them. And it has a certain dimension. Okay? And you tell me how that dimension varies as time changes and as I go out along the spatial lattice. That's part of the setup of it's like, you know, when Feynman described dynamics in terms of path integrals. This is sort of not intrinsically a Hamiltonian formalism, okay? It may become a Hamiltonian formalism for some particular arrangement of diamonds, and we want it to be consistent with some kind of Hamiltonian evolution for the unit for cosmology. And we did succeed in finding one model like that. So in our model, the rule was the following. take d steps out along the lattice. It doesn't matter in which direction. It's just any d steps that don't backtrack on each other. Each time you take a step, the overlap decreases by one pixel. That was the rule. Okay? And with that rule, and a rule for what the Hamiltonians were in all the overlaps, that basically said that the, when you go back at a single lattice point, every time you go back in time one step, you lose one pixel. So you could then say, okay, the, when the overlap has gone down by k pixels, use the Hamiltonian that you used for the single guy when he only had k pixels to play with. And that gave a solution of all the consistency conditions, that the dynamics imposed on each overlap by the dynamics in the individual causal diamonds was the same. Okay. That model with a choice for the only thing left to choose is that each time you have to tell me what the Hamiltonian is for a single observer, and then that fixes everything else. So we then chose a particular class of random Hamiltonians. And with that choice, we showed that this structure naturally defined a distance in terms of causality. The number of steps out you had to take changed with time before the before you had no overlap whatsoever. So it defined the causal distance in terms of the quantum mechanics. And then we looked at how that causal distance varied with time, how the energy density of our system defined in terms of the Hamiltonian varied with time. And those are the things that obey the scaling laws of the p equals rho geometry. Okay? And so a better model, like the one that we just heuristically put together that's supposed to describe more realistic cosmology, would have to similarly go in and prescribe overlaps for every set of pair of causal diamonds and dynamics for every pair of causal diamonds, and it's a complicated mess, and we don't know how to do it except in this rather simple kit. But that, we think, might be all you need for a definition of a quantum cosmology.
In your model, is there a necessary notion of preferred time to define your dynamics?
Yeah, but you should think of that as a gauge fixer. So okay. So the way you think about the gauge fixing in general in our cosmological models with the Big Bang is what do you have to do to have gauge fixing? You have to define time slices. Okay? So our time slices are defined in such a way that at each point in space, the area of the causal diamond that goes back to the Big Bang is the same.
Is there one causal diamond that goes back to the Big Bang, or many?
I'm sitting at some point in space, and my light cone from that at a particular time, okay, my light cone that goes back to the Big Bang, my causal diamond, I'm sorry, that goes back to the Big Bang looks like this, okay, and it's got some area. Then there's a guy on the next lattice.
You mean for a full observer? When you say my, you mean a full observer?
So
that becomes a starting point.
So you take the Big Bang as a starting point, your point on your time slice as the final point, and think of the causal diamond of that observer.
Can you imagine the Big Bang is only one point?
No. Now, let's go over to the next point on our lattice. Okay, the next point on our lattice, you think of like this, it's also got a causal diamond like this, going back to the Big Bang, the causal diamond of the observer who started over a little bit and traveled up in time along a geodesic. These end up being synchronous coordinates in the P equals rho universe, so we don't put that in. Okay.
So you get, I think the question is that you cannot have two causal diamonds that start with the same point upstairs and end up with.
No, there's only one, right?
Why?
Sorry, there's one geodesic observer, okay, that goes from here to here, okay? So,
you're assuming there's a background metric or
no, you just, this is a prescription which, when you try to interpret it in terms of geometry, will be a synchronous gauge for this background metric with these geodesic observers.
So that's part of your assumption. There's only one diameter.
That's right.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, I was just to get the picture straight of your you mentioned that there's possibly an alternative mechanism to generate a scale invariant spectrum.
Yes.
So you have a dense gas of black holes, which eventually turns into dilute gas, and it's in this process that some fluctuations appear, inhomogeneities appear. That
okay. So the fluctuations were actually there in the beginning. They were that shape that I put in the beginning gave me some inhomogeneity.
Okay.
And I don't know what they are. They have some distribution.
Right.
Now what I'm saying is evolve that through the P equals rho era. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I didn't tell you is the quantum mechanics that we defined, once you get to the this large N limit where it really looks like P equals rho, it actually has a symmetry, a scale invariance to it. Okay. So despite the fact that you might not know how to define what this initial object was, the density fluctuation, you can tell how it depends on time and on position by using that scale transformation. Okay, that scale invariance tells you at the end of the day that when I get the energy distribution of these black holes, that energy distribution has scale invariant fluctuations between a certain range of k space. Okay. Now you say this is dilute black hole gas. Now it's got certain fluctuations. Let me postulate in addition that there's a scalar field that can be an inflaton, and inflation starts when the energy density in that scalar field, which is just sitting someplace on its potential, becomes bigger than the energy density on the black hole in the black hole gas. Okay. Well, when does that happen? It depends where you are, depending on the fluctuations. So the fluctuations in the black hole gas get imprinted as fluctuations in the initial condition of the inflaton field. And then that propagates through the process of inflation and comes out the other end, and you get something. Now, so far, the best we've been able to do is to get exactly scale invariant fluctuations out. We can also get a blue tilt, but we don't want a blue tilt, obviously. So we're playing with other inflation models to see if we could get a red tilt.
Okay, just to be absolutely clear, then, so our universe is supposed to be one of these bubbles inside this black hole gas. You patched,
right.
You patched, and you're quite careful about patching this solution onto the black hole background.
Right.
In the background outside of this bubble, a scale invariant spectrum develops.
No. So inside this bubble, at its early stage, it looked like a black hole gas with a very small fluctuation in it. Okay, a dense black hole fluid, which has this scale invariance property with a small fluctuation. Okay. Now I say, let's let that fluctuation propagate until such time as by calculation we can tell, well, you have to know the initial ratio of volumes in the normal region to the dense black hole fluid region in order to figure out how long it takes till this phase transition occurs. Okay. So the scale invariance was the scale invariance of the dense black hole fluid inside the bubble before the transition took place. After the transition takes place, I just have a dilute black hole gas in a normal universe. And then the rest of it is standard cosmology. Okay, I hope I was more clear.
Yeah.
Okay. There is a coffee break now. Thank you.